Hi, this is Ricky Ortiz, lead pastor of Metachurch. I want to take a moment to introduce you to a series of conversations that we will be having on racism, faith, and progress. Recent events in the U.S. have reminded us of the deep work of reconciliation that remains and the gap that's yet to be bridged. It is abundantly clear that we must all take responsibility to be part of the solution. We can no longer remain silent or absent. These conversations are our attempt to offer insight, provoke personal change, and share hope for how we can all move forward. These conversations are not perfect. They're raw, they're unedited, and they're unfiltered. But we believe having conversations like these are a part of our responsibility to create a better and more hope-filled future complete with justice and equality for people of color. So take your time to listen to each episode, process what you hear, and work for the greater good of all people. And wherever it is appropriate, please share these conversations so others can do the same. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to the Let's Talk Racism podcast video. I'm back with my friends Peter and T again after a great part one of our conversation. And to be honest, we kind of just ran out of time. And so we decided, let's come back and do this again. And so this time, we're not going to run out of time. But we're continuing this conversation about the importance of sharing and telling Black stories. And I know for a lot of people that watched or listened to part one of this conversation, a lot of people, a lot of great things coming, great insights and, enlightening for a lot of people. So I want to just say thank you to T and Peter for jumping back on and doing a part two with me. I'm wearing my Black Boy Joy shirt. And so supporting the cause. But I just, for those of you, if you missed part one, just to kind of fill you in, Peter and T are both documentarians, so they record filmmaking, photography, and just kind of, we're going to jump into some of their work a little bit about the stories that they do tell, but that's kind of what we're focusing on in this conversation is the importance of continuing on why does it matter that we tell Black stories, and as we talked about in the last conversation, not just from the standpoint of like, look how poor people are, look how much violence there is, or using that to perpetuate humor or further perpetuate stereotypes or racist ideas on the worst case scenario. So we're just going to jump into a question number one. Let's just kind of go from the beginning, like in your guys' opinion, why is it so important to highlight and to give space for Black stories and the Black experience from, Africa to where you lived and San Diego, where you grew up, why does that matter to you guys? And why do you think it's so important?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for the question. I really like this one. I have three things that I did write down. History, cultural preservation, and the importance of oral stories. So I remember in our last conversation, Ricky, you brought up oral stories and how important that was. And that really got my mind thinking about how broad that subject matter is and that it's really important for us to document those stories. And it really took me back to slavery, where those stories were actual oral stories and they were documented, written stories. So now we have a way to go back in history, which a lot of our own history as Black people, it's just not there because they weren't recording that. But we were able to gain, some of our own history back from those oral stories that were just passed on from generation to generation. And then comparing them to the ones that are actually written as well. So I feel that that is a huge component of just making sure that we are preserving what is happening throughout our history. So that definitely ties into cultural preservation, which is really important. Something that I got more into by spending time in West Africa. There are so many incredible, Peter can, of course, he is like a pro at explaining all of it. But to me, I just thought, wow, if there were so many people who, especially people of color, who knew what was happening in our continent, they could connect those two things together, how amazing that would be. Sure. So, for example, one of our stories that we worked on together was Becoming a Man. And I can let Peter talk a little bit more just about the history behind that, and then I can jump back in.
So real quick, before you do that, like cultural preservation, the idea, the phrase, like it might be new or unfamiliar for myself or someone else. So how would you guys kind of like, I guess in a way, like what do you mean by like cultural preservation? Just so that everyone kind of gets what you're talking about there.
Yeah, so it's just preserving the history. It's preserving specific cultural events, rituals, even if there are some type of traditional practices that happen within different cultural or ethnic groups. Right. So it's making sure that those things are documented. So we have a visual history of it as well as written history.
Got it. Awesome.
So you can go ahead and explain a little bit about Becoming a Man, the history.
Yeah.
And I can jump back in.
Well, the first thing I would like to also add to the point you've already raised is that, I mean, depiction of Black stories really promotes negativity and stereotype as well, right? So for me, there are a lot of, I think it's good for Black people to really tell their story. You know, this is my own opinion anyway. Because nobody can really tell our story the way we want to really tell our stories, you know. So there are a lot of, you know, stories out there that does not really represent us the way, you know, it's meant to be. So for us to go in and you want to tell your story, it's going to be different from the way other, what is it called now, other... in my place, we call it tribe, but other races, you know, want to like probably tell the story. Races. The other races want to probably tell the story. So I believe, in my own opinion, this is my own personal opinion, that it's really very important for the Black people to really tell their story the way, you know, the story is really, not to change a lot of things as well, to have a very, very perfect story.
An accurate depiction of what took place.
Exactly. So in like talking about the documentary that we just produced together, that we recently just finished, Breaking Forth, it's about a boxer, you know. It's about a boxer. That's what you're talking about.
Becoming a man. I want you to do Becoming a Man first.
Okay. Sorry, we have both.
That, we have a few.
So there's a particular, you know, story from a particular village or a tribe in the southern part of Nigeria. So they try to really preserve their culture, their heritage, right? And still keep everything intact, even in the 21st century, because of this whole Christianity going on in Africa, that's where a lot of this whole mix-up really comes in from, right? Now, people see it as really not being the right thing to do because it's involved a lot of traditional ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because then in Africa, it was all like traditional things anyway. So before the whole Christian thing was introduced there to us. So for us, there were ways of us doing things, worshiping our gods, right? So those things, that particular community still tried to, you know, preserve that and hold on to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they are fighting against, like, this new development coming in, this 21st century ways of doing things and all of that. So it's very difficult. So when I told, you know, my wife that, hey, part of what we'll do is to try and, you know, really tell of these stories anyway. For us to, like, show the world, hey, this is what is going on there. This is how people are perceiving the whole thing. But this is what is really happening. So it was for me and her to say, hey, how can we really document this whole thing? So we were able to go there just to understand the reason why they are still doing it and why they will continue doing it. So it's a hereditary thing, kind of celebration, right? So it's nothing bad. It's just what we all practice, you know, in our various communities. But then they call it becoming a man. So becoming a man is like you get to a particular age in that community, then there's an initiation thing that happens for you to now be regarded as a man.
Yeah.
So you have to carry out the task, you know, for you to, it's all different festivities going on. So you need to like go to a particular place, do what you need to do and all of that in a traditional way. It does not stop you from being a Christian. It does not stop you from not being a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, a lot of people, because there's one man we interviewed, like, he did the whole thing, but he said that he's a Christian now, but he's not going to allow his children
to do it.
You know, that already, it's also right. Like, I kind of see that when I heard that part from his interview, I kind of like felt like bad in a way, because that was your decision. You did it. So, you know, your child is going to also take this decision. So that's where the whole mess up comes. So for me to be able, for us to be able to go in there and really document it properly to say, hey, this is what it means, not the way it's being portrayed, like, oh, they are evil or it's a voodoo kind of thing, and, you know, it's not a Christianity, it does not align with God's purpose and all of that. That's not the purpose there. So why how would they stay doing it? This is the reason why they are doing it. It's something that they need to keep. Because by the time you take that in out of that community, the community is more or less like empty. There's nothing for them to celebrate anymore. You know, so they have to try and keep, you know, keep to it and preserve it. So that, I think that's what you mean by, you know, exactly. Cultural preservation.
So that's like an example of
the cultural preservation, how you're mm-hmm. trying to, like, you know, really portray this story in a way that you don't depict it in the way that they are all like bad stories as well.
Yeah.
And also,
yeah.
No. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, like, it's kind of like, I don't know that it's the opposite of cultural assimilation, but it works almost at odds with cultural assimilation. So this is just totally off the cuff, and I'm just kind of talking out loud. I don't have my full thoughts on what I feel about the whole idea of cultural assimilation. Like, they're not fully fleshed out or fully materialized, but I have mixed feelings, to say the least. And so, you know, and I think, you know, just for the sake of this conversation, not to digress, but like, I think the thing with cultural assimilation is, like, for instance, I move into an African culture, let's say, or context, and you're talking about these traditions and these customs and the rituals that are practiced and have been passed down from generation, generation, generation. There's an aspect where, you know, maybe I might want to engage in those things, learn about them, participate, experience them for myself. But the moment that all of a sudden I move there and now it's like, hey, you moved here to our place, so you need to let go of any sort of cultural affiliation you had back in the United States or from your Puerto Rican family or from your Colombian family. And now you need to become like us. That's the assimilation part. That's where I think racist ideas and racist divides start to come in. And so when we limit or when we put a cap on what kind of cultural experiences are acceptable or which ones we're willing to, quote, tolerate, then I think what we actually end up doing is creating greater racial divides. Because what we're saying is, well, that's, you know, that's not what I would do. So if you want to be like me, which is a crazy presumption anyway, but if you want to be like me or if you want to be accepted by me, then you have to do what I do or do what I think is allowable or permissible. And so I think, you know, again, that's just kind of dovetailing a little bit off of what you guys are talking about here. But I think that's one of the pieces that's so important. And that storytelling piece is that you're helping highlight what matters to people. And it's not about, you know, saying, well, this is a right or wrong in an objective manner, as much as it is about saying this is what's taking place. And that's where, you know, there are things that are right or wrong, right? Like, you know, obviously there are things that there's a line. It's not to say there's not a line. But when it's a matter of an opinion or a preference versus like a moral dilemma, then, you know, or like a legal dilemma, let's say, then that's where I think, you know, we have to, I think that's one of the places, whether you're Christian or not Christian, where we can make a greater allowance and seek to understand versus trying to force people to understand us.
Right. And I also believe that, I mean, once you go into a particular community or any, depending on the story you really want to tell, right? So for us, we try to really focus more on the positive side of it, you know, and how it's going to impact people's life positively, for people to even know more about it. Because a lot of times we tend to really focus more on the negativities that is coming out of a particular place or, you know, a particular person's life and all of that. Because that tends to really generate a lot of tractions or, you know, once you're telling, you know, saying, or you're filming a story about a particular place or someone, and everything you keep hearing is like how this person is like bad or suffering or like this. So everybody wants to like, hey, look at the way they look at the whole thing and all of that. But that is not the case, you know, for us here. Yes, there are places that have that negative side to their stories and all of that. But if you tell this side of story, mix between the positive and the negative side together, right? And you really have a proper story. So that makes sense than you really ignoring the other side and focusing more on this other side. Mm-hmm. So that's the problem now. That's where, you know, I think your faith also have to like come in to say, hey, what do you really believe in as well, right? So like, do you want to like really keep depicting these people the way people see them outside or the way you want then people to really see them now that you are there, you are really experiencing the whole thing.
Because, and I, can really quick, I wanted to say too, I think the importance like back to what we were originally talking about, like the importance of it and bridging that gap between Africans and the African-American community as well is so critical and important, because often, like Peter was saying, some of these cultural traditions can be interpreted as something very bad, something that is very harmful and very damaging. And just like you were saying, Ricky, while there are some things that we know are definitely not okay to do, are bad or harmful mm-hmm. to a certain group of people, that is such a small percentage, you know, in comparison to the vast amount of cultural traditions that can really connect us, not only just for Africans and African-Americans, but for everyone as a whole. You can really understand, have a deeper understanding of exactly why this tradition took place, why it was stopped, mm-hmm. you know, what we're talking about with colonization and these things and how that affected the community. So with, I thought Becoming a Man was such a perfect example of that, because unbeknownst to me, I didn't know that there was this issue between it stopping when colonization entered. You know, based off of what I understood, it was a tradition that just continued to go on. So even to hear that, and like Peter was saying with the interview with that particular man, and to say, oh, well, I'm you know, I'm not really sure if I want my son to do it, that affected me as well. And I'm not, you know, even a part of that community, but even as an African-American person, understanding like that stripping, that rejection, and just that demotion, you know, of our history, which actually allows us to understand ourselves deeper. Which is why, you know, cultural preservation is such a big part of that, of us telling our stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's like, you hit on something, like there's a, like one thing that's like there's, it's really practical. And it's so crucial. Like, you know, we, so there's this fundamental, like in sociology, what's called the fundamental attribution error. And so essentially it's this, it's, you know, me and Peter have the same job. We live in the same apartment. We start at the same time. And I get to work on time, and or Peter gets to work on time. I show up late. What, you know, Peter will say is like, oh, it's because I'm you know, I'm always on time. I'm punctual. I'm a good employee. I respect others. And then Ricky shows up late and it's like, oh, he's lazy. He doesn't care about other people. And it's like, we could have had the exact same situation. But what we do, this whole idea of this attribution error, is that we want to take credit for what we perceive to be good. And then when someone else doesn't match up to that, we look for every reason why they're bad. And so, you know, you kind of said this about like, you know, focusing on the positive. It's not that you discredit or that you remove any sort of what's negative. But actually, like when we look for the positive first, what we find is there's way more common ground. So, you know, there's different situations where we might believe like, you know what? We actually want the same thing, desire the same thing, but we just have different ways of getting there. We you know, the destination is the same. The bridges that we're building look different. But what's to say that those bridges are bad or wrong just because it's different than yours? I mean, like here in New York, right? There's all sorts of different types of bridges. They're constructed differently. They look different and they were intended with different purposes, but the end result is to get people to the same location. And I think in relationships, like, and in stories and in this aspect of race, is we have to be able to, you know, start there. Like, what do we share in common? What is our desire? What are the commonalities that we have? And if we can begin there, then we can kind of work around whatever we perceive to be discrepancies or issues. It creates a basis for having, you know, that progress, versus if we're always looking for something that divides us, like we'll always find a reason because of this fundamental attribution error. Like we can always excuse what someone else does or excuse what we do and then blame what someone else does. And I think that's one of those big pieces that, you know, I think is so missed, you know, on the whole, from whether it's storytelling or just how we interact personally one-to-one. We completely miss out on that. You guys kind of talked a little bit about, real quick, two questions. You said history, cultural preservation. Then what was the third piece about the importance of sharing Black stories? Oral stories. And then, you kind of mentioned this a little bit before you called, but like on the flip side of that, you know, when we don't tell the whole story or when we don't work to tell the whole story, like what are some of the negatives or some of the damaging things that take place? And you guys were kind of talking a little bit about a documentary you're watching that kind of triggered some other thoughts. So kind of fill us in a little bit on that.
Yeah, definitely. The documentary watched over the weekend that, you know, focused in on poverty sort of showed the benefits that many people are receiving from marginalized populations remaining in poverty. So whether it be some nonprofit organizations or other organizations who go in with the right intentions, with their heart in the right place, not really understanding the full scale of the issue that's happening in a particular location. So for example, in the United States, for sure, I'm sure everybody has seen multiple clothing drives to send clothes overseas, whether it be, to any developing countries, right? Yeah.
Especially in churches.
Yes, exactly.
Sock drives and all that stuff.
Right. And, you know, we really believe all of us are guilty of it as, I shouldn't say everyone, but majority of people who have ever donated, you know, we are perceiving this as something good. We are going to send, you know, our clothes that we're not using, or we're going to buy clothes, and we're going to support, you know, these people who are quote unquote in need. But through this documentary, it really showed how our good deed is actually really impacting these communities in a very negative way, in these countries in a negative way. So, for example, some of the organizations that were collecting all of the clothes, once the clothes got to the locations, you just see piles and piles and piles of a lot of clothes truly that shouldn't even be sent. I was a little surprised by seeing just unwearable items. I didn't think that was a really very ethical either. But with all that dumping, mass dumping of clothing, then the individuals in that community just end up wearing those clothes. So now there's not even a need for the small business owners who were creating these garments for their community. They're out of business now.
Yeah.
So there's this lack of understanding of the cycle, and this is for all of us. Like I said, we're especially us in the United States. We can all learn from this and gain from it. This is definitely not an attack on anyone, but we have to understand the cycle and the process of how our good deed can actually not be one. Even though our heart is in the right place, it can cause more harm than good. And I thought, wow, this is so incredible how this documentary has laid out this exact thing that we're talking about. And now you have this information and these tools that you can make a change. So it's not that there aren't communities that need clothes. That's not what we're saying, you know, and that's not what the documentary is saying. What they're saying is, let's think about how we can partner with the individuals that are already creating these garments and these items. And another thing that I think is also really important for us to keep in mind as well, that this was brought up, and I know in my time of just traveling, meeting different people and having conversations with them, there's always this idea that in these developing countries, they just don't have these things. They don't have designers, you know, they don't have people who are electricians or, you know, just all these fundamental things that you need to create a productive society. And they're so inaccurate. And when we go in having that idea, or even if you're not able to travel, if you're just, you know, supporting an organization or whatever, we have to think about these individuals who are already on ground. So I love the organizations that are partnering with small businesses and trying to create sustainable change and not just like momentary gain. And I thought that was really important, like you were saying, Ricky, about just sharing accurate, once again, stories, being sure that you really are taking the time as a documentarian to research, you know, and to really understand what is happening. Of course, there's all these little surprises that come along the way, and you're like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. Let me add that to the story that I'm telling, which is always, like, so great whenever that happens. Yeah. But just to go in with an understanding that sometimes what we're thinking is, quote unquote, very good to do really is more harmful.
Yeah, and that, you know, and I can attest, like, I saw that and experienced that myself firsthand, like, when I went to Haiti in 2017. And I'd been to the island of Hispaniola before. You know, Haiti shares an island with Dominican Republic. And I've been to the Dominican part of the island and visited there and experienced things there. But then went to Haiti, and it was unlike anything I'd ever experienced, which Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. But I saw this very thing. I went to work with an organization called Hands and Feet Project, which works to create dignified and offer dignified work to Haitians through artisanal work and skill development versus, like, you know, just kind of simple subsidiaries or whatever. But, you know, we saw piles and piles of clothing that were imported from, you know, a brand here in the U.S., Goodwill Company, which we all think about, like, clothing donation, that had just been offloaded, you know, right there in Port-au-Prince. And it's like, you know, bales of clothing that's not really usable, like sweatshirts. Like, what are you doing sending sweatshirts to Haiti? You know, like, that's just, it doesn't make sense. But then when you talk about the ingenuity, for instance, like, where I stayed was kind of like a pretty decent sized like concrete building. But right next to this this place was a family of maybe five, I think it was. And the boy at the time was probably like 8 years old, 8 or 9 years old, had essentially collected the remaining like cement that was being used for the construction of the building and like the cement dust. And it created like what the closest thing that I could kind of describe it as for anyone listening is like a pizza oven, like a brick pizza oven, or like a concrete pizza oven that he created so that his family could cook at home. So you talk about like this whole thing of like, well, here's a problem. And then the presumption that there aren't like creative people or entrepreneurial spirits or whatever. It's like, here's an 8-year-old boy that did more with concrete dust than I ever thought, you know, possible. I could Google how to do that and still wouldn't figure it out. And he made a workable, serviceable oven for his family to be able to cook and provide for themselves. And so it's kind of like, it's, you know, and I think that kind of speaks to this next point that I want to talk about. Like, what, like, in your guys' storytelling, whether it's this story about becoming a man, or, you know, you referenced this documentary about the boxer, like, as you guys are telling these stories, what difference do you see it making for those communities and the people that either it represents or the people that are a part of the storytelling?
Breaking forth all the way. Yeah. Thinking about breaking forth.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, the first time I saw the, let me just, you know, in reference to the breaking forth story, the boxer, because that story is very peculiar to, like, I really like the story a lot, and it's so, so dear to my heart because of how I saw her image somewhere, right? And I remember we were together, and I told her, I was like, hey, look at this, you know, girl, she looks so masculine, right? And she's a boxer. I really like to do her story. Then I started, like, I don't know her from anywhere, right? Then I started, like, looking for a way to, like, to see who even took the picture from there, to be able to know, where did you take the pictures from? You know, how can I get to this person and all of that? Then it took me a while, and eventually, you know, I met her. So now, already, I can clearly see that she came from a not a middle class, from a poverty kind of, like, background, right? I can easily tell that. So she's trying to, like, really fight her way, you know, into to be able to, you know, have a better life for herself as well. So, and I'm seeing that whole thing from that image. So when I saw her and we just talked, and I now realize what she's even doing with the little thing she had already. So immediately my focus switched to that thing, to the way, you know, I am now seeing her, not the way other people would have seen her, you know. So seeing her was not from, hey, you are poor, I'm going to do this story around you because you're poor. So I was already seeing how she can be able to use her story to also influence people in her community there, right? So I now realized that, look, the focus is not for me to focus more on on her poverty background, but to focus more on, yes, I'll still talk about the poverty, right? But I still need to also share the part where she's trying to really break these barriers for herself and all the struggles and everything she's going through. So that, for me, really made the story to be good. And from there, I realized, hey, she's not just a boxer, right? She's a housewife. She has a kid. And she's a seamstress as well, you know? So while she is there, yes, she's poor, but she's trying to figure these things out. And she's doing all of these things to try and really change her lifestyle and all of that. So the purpose of that whole thing is for people not to really focus. I want people to see the story, for them not to focus on her poverty, but for them to see what she's trying to do with her life and how she's trying to get out of that thing. And from there, she has even represented Nigeria already, you know, at the Commonwealth Games, right? From just that small place, she has represented a country of over 200 million people at the Commonwealth Games. Yeah. That is massive. Now, that's her story. Because anytime I do a story, I learn from their lifestyle. You know, it kind of like just impart on me, and I'm trying to like use it to change my own life and the way I see things. So I've not represented my country, right, in any way or something. So, but she has, you know, and she needs to be celebrated for doing that. But who are the people who even documented that? There's nobody. Because they're like, hey, you live in a particular place, you know, we just don't care, you know, about you.
Right.
They don't think that people there, you know, they can really change things, or they are creative, or they have their own life, you know, they are trying to really survive. So for me, breaking forth, telling that story was for me to really try and really put my stamp on the whole thing about the focus is not always for me to focus on your ways of living, but to focus on what you are bringing to the table. Then I cannot take people back to how you're living. So once I've been able to convince people like, this is what you are trying to do, this is what you're doing, then I will not take people back to, you know, where you are from, so that it humbles a lot of them. Then for them to say, hey, if this person can do this, I can also do this as well. It sort of encouragement to all of us, or whether you are wealthy or you are, you know, you are poor, it's just to encourage all of us. So that alone, you know, kind of like pushed me to doing more of that whole thing. You understand? So I really like, I wish people can really see, you know, because it's like, it's not like in public yet, the story, right? But that's, for me, when we are on that project, because she was with me in Lagos, I was filming that project, and she saw her and how she is, really makes me feel sad, right? That she's struggling to break all these barriers just to like be able to, first of all, fighting for herself and for her country.
Mm-hmm.
But she's poor. So my focus is, let's focus on you fighting for your country and fighting for yourself. Then let's not focus on the poverty, how you were raised, you know, how, what you went through for you to be able to even get to this stage. You know, so for me, that's kind of like really explain this particular question, you know, you just ask. I just wish people can really go there and really focus on that. And besides, you know, other thing that I also experienced during the whole documentary, that particular story, because I was invited to the UK on the documentary forum for me to like be part of System Filmmakers and all of that. Look, yep,
that's when I got to go to London.
Yeah. So what I noticed with that whole thing is that there is this, I don't think people really understand this unbiased mindset when it comes to some certain people. You know, so while you guys were talking about unconscious bias, while you guys were talking about this whole dumping thing and all of that, there is a way they really kind of see us, the black skin, especially if you're from Africa, right? You know, they kind of like really see you as, you know, you have to really be dependent on whatever it is. They don't see it in the way that you can really create some certain things yourself. So what that really shows me was, if there was few people liked it, right? But they liked the story. Of course, they always liked the story because it's showing like how Africa or Nigeria, you know, the other poverty area and all of that. But
this is in the UK when you went
to the UK. So when I had conversations with some media outlets out there, that we're trying to pitch the story to, you know, so we're all like pitching and all of that. So I realized how some people took the stories, how some people really, really liked the story, but they wanted to change the narratives again, back to that whole thing again. So they wanted to change the narrative. So I was having issues with that. So they liked it. Then I went back to Africa. Then we started conversations and all of that. So after the whole period of time, they just went cold feet on me. And only for them to reach out back to me to tell me that, hey, if I would be willing to change the story. And I told them, change the story from what to what. But they want to be the one to tell me what I need to take out, what I need to add there. Of course, I was not going to do that because I can't do that. This is my story.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I want the story to be out there, you are providing me that platform to put the story out there. But because of that, you're trying to take advantage of me, knowing fully well that I don't have that medium to, you know, take the story out there, to try and change the narratives on me,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is so, so wrong. And I didn't allow them to do that. So that was when everything just collapsed with them, but with the whole negotiations and all of that. Then I also reached out to some other people. They now said, hey, they have story like that in Africa, but they can't, you know, really, you know, take this other one and all of that. And I said, yeah, but Africa is not a country. Africa is a continent.
It's a continent.
So if you have a story of a boxer in Nigeria, it's going to be different from the story of a boxer you have in Morocco or in Tunisia.
You can have multiple Gambia, stories.
You know, but they're all just different one stories. Story. You know, they're all different stories. Then they now told me back to this same thing again about they always start up a story from beginning to the end. They don't take a story that has already been completed, which means that they want to change the narrative from beginning. They want to be in control. They want to be in charge of the narratives before you even start. So that broken forth, not just to focus on Aisha alone, reveal a lot of things to me, how they really seen us, how, you know, every time we are in an organization, if another skin color is trying to do something once, I have to probably do it 5 times for me to be able to convince other people to do it. And if that story, just think about it, if that story was from someone with another race, let's say in Europe, I know for sure, and it does not hurt me knowing about this, you know, it didn't hurt me. I felt bad about it, you know, briefly, but I just woken up from my sleep and all of that. If it was from another race from that European country, right, I know for sure that they would have picked it up. No doubt. Because I know the story I have. This girl from a poor background to a Commonwealth Games. That's a massive story. It's a powerful story. I know what I had. But the barrier, what I was fighting was too much. I was fighting my continent where I'm from, how they see me, which I can't change them from seeing us like that. And I was also fighting my skin color at the same time as well. So that alone, you know, probably just explain this whole question you just asked about how, you know, things have been done as well.
Yeah, that's really powerful. And so I appreciate you sharing that and being, you know, vulnerable with that, because it's not something easy to kind of speak to. And, you know, I think that, so one, I'm sorry, you know, that's what you've faced and experienced in that. Even if you say like, oh, it doesn't, you know, sometimes I wonder, like, as people of color, do we say like, oh, it didn't affect me? Or have we learned to build up like a thick enough wall where like we, you know, to protect ourselves, because we've been affected so much already. So one, I'm sorry, you know, that was your experience, and you know, a couple things that I just thought about and was like writing down. I think too, what you're speaking to obviously speaks to a systemic, you know, injustice and a systemic, you know, bias and a systemic, you know, form of racism, or a form of systemic racism, I should say, better put. But I think on a personal level, like what I wrote down is like, when we play into racist stereotypes, what we are personally doing is compromising our own integrity. What they were asking you to do was to compromise your integrity, but that's because they've already compromised their own. And I think on a personal level, when I think about like, if I'm just listening to this right now and I'm just in my car driving or listening on my phone or whatever, or watching online, like when I, like what I want you to hear is like, when you allow yourself to agree with or fall into, again, whether it's a, unconscious bias or a racist idea or a racist connotation or a supposition of, well, Black people from Africa must all be poor. And so that must be the driving or the leading storyline or headline in this. What you are doing is compromising your own integrity. And obviously, like, in a right or wrong way, but when I think about integrity of a person, I think about the integrity similar to like the integrity of a structure or a building. The foundation's got to be right. The support beams have to be in place. The load-bearing walls all have to be, you know, in existence. And those buildings are constructed to withstand high wind, high resistance, earthquake to a certain degree. That's integrity. And that's the same for our being, is that everything has to be congruent and in alignment with one another if we want to build something that's upright and that stands the test of time. And so when we fall prey, when we succumb to those kind of things, or just whether it's, I would say fall prey, like when we actively engage in those kind of things, what we're doing is compromising our own ability to stand upright. And I think that's one of the things that people don't understand when it comes to to racism on the whole, is that this is a compromise of yourself, and then to ask others to agree with you is asking them to compromise themselves. And that's the injustice in all of that, you know, and that's where, you know, it comes across wrong. On a related, but kind of separate note, like I thought about a sermon to preach, when you were talking, about, and so, but like, you know, this whole story about like, you know, like, again, practically, like as you tell this story of like, here's what she had and here's what she started to take advantage of, you know, whether it was, you know, as a seamstress or obviously as a gifted athlete, and a skilled athlete. It's not just the gift, but it's the tenacity and the skill and the work ethic, that it requires to perform and to achieve at that level that she did. But, you know, it made me think of the story of Moses. And Exodus, you know, 3 and 4, and it's and you can't think of the story of the Hebrew people and the Egyptians without slavery, without oppression, and without racism. And so, you know, when you look at that story, and it's like Moses, like, well, what am I supposed to do? Like, that's Pharaoh. How am I going to release them? How am I going to, you know, do anything that's going to, you know, convince this person to let my you know, let your people go? And God says to him, like, an interesting question. He's like, what do you got in your hand? And he's like, I got this staff. And he's like, throw it on the ground. And then it turns into a serpent, right? And then he's like, pick it back up. And boom, it's like, and then this staff, like, yeah, that worked as part of like the plagues and the convincing of Pharaoh. But that staff also became the staff that parted the Red Sea. That staff also became the staff that brought healing when the people were plagued and they were like the snake bitten. And they held up the staff and Moses held up his rod. You know, the people, when they looked to that, received healing. That rod and that staff also became the battle of victory, where Joshua and Aaron came and had to hold up Moses' hands, because anytime he had the staff up in the air, Moses, the Hebrew people were winning in battle. And so it all started with like, what do you have in your hand? And again, when you think about storytelling, I think that's so powerful, because it's like, what you start with, what you have, versus like looking at like, well, what do I already believe? What do you know? What is the stigma or the stereotype that I can continue to, you know, like. It's like when you're trying to tell a story, you're looking at like, what is unique about this individual? Because again, to say, well, Ricky's Puerto Rican, so that if he does this one thing, that must mean all Puerto Ricans are like that. Well, that's not true. You know, it's not like who am I to, you know, represent an entire ethnic group? I'm an individual. I make autonomous decisions. I make individual choices. And so it's that same thing. So I think that's super powerful. What about you, T, through like, you know, photography and some of your art and creative outlets? Like, how are you telling stories? Like I mentioned, I'm wearing this Black Boy Joy shirt, which I love. But like, what are the things that you're doing to, like, this is a story. It's a story in a print. It's a story on, in this case, a shirt. But how are you using kind of your craft to help share and highlight these stories as well?
Definitely. I love Black Boy Joy. I love that series. Of course, I started it many years ago. And yeah. One thing that I love about my artist shop is that it's given me the ability to share my work on a much more global scale. And before all these other things took place, Black Boy Joy has always just been something that many from all backgrounds gravitated towards. And I thought that was really interesting, because it was not really what I expected initially. But then when I go back and, you know, I review what everyone is most interested in my store, it's, Black Boy Joy is at the top. And I love that personally. So I would love to share a little bit of how it all came to fruition.
Yeah, go for it.
So, yeah, I noticed that throughout my work, I had all these images of just joyful young African-American boys. So whether I would be shooting for myself, shooting something personally, or I was on set or whatever, I had all of these pictures, a whole archive of just this joyfulness of African-American boys and girls. I know you know already, Ricky, but I've worked with children for a long period of time. I really love working with children, so that's very heavily integrated into my work. And I said, you know what? I think I'm just going to create a gallery, like a small gallery on my website about Black Boy Joy. And there was a particular killing that did take place of a young African-American boy. And this, I think, probably was around 2014. And that also really spurred me to create something that was different from the narrative that was constantly being projected out there in mass media. Yeah. I felt that I had a duty to really share that joy and that importance. So I put it all together and I got so much amazing feedback. I was very surprised because I wasn't sure, you never know.
Right. Yeah.
So I got so much amazing feedback. So many people were very interested, you know, in all the individuals in my stories, and they're very candid photos too. And I'm a portrait photographer, so I like things to, you know, really look a certain way. But in deciding to share this personal aspect of myself, I saw that it gained so much closeness to individuals. You know, they connected with it. I wrote a little story about it, but really, I mean, most people didn't need the story at all. They got it right away. Yeah. You know, they saw, like, this is a beautiful image of, you know, young African-American boys, you know, having a wonderful time at the beach, or some of the other images are just being out, you know, like I said, just candid moments. And that has continued to propel me to just share more of those, share them on.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, thank you. Share them on my website, you know, share them within my community and ask others to share as well. And for a moment, I wasn't sure if I wanted, you know, that particular image to be put on a t-shirt. I grappled with that a little bit. And I wasn't sure if doing that would really spread the message that I was intending. But a beautiful thing is that I get these customer photos with these long stories that are so beautifully written about how impactful this image has been for them, how they're so proud to wear it in their community, how they want to share this story and how they want to talk about this. And I just love that that has and continues to be the outcome from that series. But once again, that to me is rooted in the historical component of sharing these images from a certain particular time over a certain amount of years. Which I still continue to photograph as well. But now we're showing, you know, these accurate depictions of young African-American boys really enjoying themselves and young African-American men as well. And while that was not my intention originally, like I said, it was just sort of something I was doing unconsciously. So going back in my archives and then creating this series, I think really speaks to the truth of the moment that we're in now and then what was happening before. And it's a way, I think, this particular image is a way to maybe for some, they may feel more comfortable wearing something like that without like words or a particular message, but just showing a visual. It shows, you know, how powerful photography is too.
Yeah.
And I definitely wanted to kick in on Aisha on breaking forth too, because I thought that this was really interesting when Peter first was telling me about Aisha, that he was moved, you know, by this image that he saw of her. She was in the boxing ring, and he showed me the photo, and the photo was really good. And I was like, yeah, wow. Like, you could just see the strength, the tenacity, you know, in her through the image. And one of the first things I told Peter was that, you know, I want you, if you are wanting to create a story around her, it's really important that when you speak to her, when you approach her, that she understands where your heart is. Because so often, especially with women, you know, our stories can be taken into the wrong hands. Or misinterpreted, and what the woman is actually trying to portray then becomes inaccurate. You know, it's not exactly what she wanted to express. Yeah. And I let Peter know, especially as a male, you know, to just be really mindful of how, you know, you're approaching her, and she, you know, let her know that this is really coming from your heart, that you really want to share her story. The purposes behind why you want to share that story and how it can make an impact for not only herself, but her community. And when he had the conversation with her, it was like immediately she was on board. And spending time with her and her husband and her kids and her family. I feel like even now, just speaking about it, I always just feel this immense amount of joy in knowing that this, you know, we created this and this is going to be here forever, know, long after we're gone. Mm-hmm. So whether we're receiving approval or quote unquote, recognition from these higher media outlets, of course, while we would love that because we want it to be on a more mass scale, to me, the importance is that we have documented her story, and this is a historical record.
Yeah.
And it has, you know, reached some people now, and maybe later on it will reach more.
Mm-hmm.
But just the fact that this story was created, it's created in a thoughtful, ethical way, and is in a complete, accurate portrayal. You know, she was a part of the process.
Yeah.
Of course, every step of the way. You know, we're sharing such an intimate part of herself.
Yeah.
So, you know, for us, we could never think of doing that without having, you know, the approval of the individual who's allowing us to share their story.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that all of that was created just in the short time that we got to know her, mm-hmm. and we were able to just create such an accurate depiction of her story. And then, you know, to learn that she's winning these competitions and, you know, she is just like killing it, which we already knew because she's so talented.
Yeah.
But to combine that, you know, all together and to see where else she's going to go in her journey is a great experience. And even some of the competitions that I was blessed enough to be a part of, and I photographed a few of them. I mean, there were so many women from all different parts of the continent who came to compete. And of course, in my mind, I'm like, we need to get all their stories. Like, we need to make connections and, you know, meet each of them and sit down with them. And it's because I really, you know, want that part of the narrative to be out there in society. I really want people to see that there are these young women that are breaking so many barriers. But it was just a side note, just a wonderful thing to see how many other women who are, you know, like her, similar to her, who I'm sure have similar backgrounds and who are taking on multiple jobs, have children, are trying to play all these different roles while still chasing after their dream. I thought that was powerful.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
it's really good. And I think, you know, it speaks to kind of like, to me, one of the worst and laziest things about racism is that it takes an idea or a belief and labels it or blasts it across an entire people group. And like I said, lazy, because each person is an individual. Each person has their own story, their own set of experiences, and their own why. There may be some commonalities. There may be some similarities between themselves and someone else or whatever. Or it might be a story that reminds us of another story in the past. But I think just making it like super practical, like for any like person listening, it's like it's why it's so important that you get to know a person's story. that you get to know who they are, that you get to speak and have conversation and invest and care. And I think this is kind of like, you know, whether it's Aisha's story or the photo used for the Black Boy Joy. Like I wrote this down, like one of the beautiful things about it. And to me, like I'm not an art critic. So I don't, you know, I don't know like proper or formal like terminology, but like there's this part of it that like, it's so humanizing. And now there's this, on the backside of that, it almost sounds like a backsided compliment or backhanded compliment, because there's a part of culture society that wants to dehumanize through racist ideas and through racist beliefs, particularly in telling Black stories. And so it sounds weird to say, oh, a photo of kids playing at the beach is humanizing. But it is, like, and because, and I think, again, like, you know, I grew up in Daytona Beach, where I was born in New York, moved to Daytona Beach in middle school, high school. And then lived in college, lived in Jacksonville, Florida, which is also like another beach city. And like, you know, a lot of people go to the beach, but a lot of people don't think about Black people going to the beach. And then of course, why? Because you think about like, you say, you know, there's like racist jokes or stereotypes or all these things that like perpetuate that. Like I went to the beach yesterday in New Jersey and there was plenty of Black people there, right? Like it's like, Black people go to the beach, you know, public, like PSA, public service announcement, Black people go to the beach. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and so like to see kids playing at the, you know, playing at a beach, playing in the water, like in this print, it's so powerful because like, that's like any kid would do. What kid wouldn't want to go into the ocean and play or whatever, have fun with their friends? You know, Aisha's story, it's like you're, why it's groundbreaking is because it humanizes a person and that, you know, that shared humanity then becomes a bridge for compassion. And if we can have compassion and empathy, then we can actually start to create processes and paths for reconciliation, for progress, for equity and equality. And that's why those pieces of storytelling are so critical. And I think, again, on the personal side, you don't have to be a documentarian to get to know someone's story. You know what I mean? You don't have to, like, you just got to be a human. Like that's it. You just got to care. And it's so, you know, frustrating on the one hand, when we don't make those efforts, when we don't, you know, try, and when we don't, because again, racism is lazy. And the goal and the objective is to degrade. And so like, if it's easier for me to just believe one negative thing about an entire people group than actually get to know one person in that people group and allow for their life story to debunk that one belief, I don't want to do that, because that requires humility and work on my part, not theirs. And that's something that I think, you know, all of us, regardless of our race, you know, can be and should be better at. So like just kind of on the whole, like when in telling stories, like there's, I guess this, I'll put this last part, like kind of at the same package them together. But on the one hand, like how is your work and telling Black stories and telling the stories of your, you know, of your people, how has that been received? And then Peter kind of alluded to this earlier. So we'll kind of, you know, maybe there's other areas or whatever, like kind of couple this together, but like what type of like pushback or resistance have you guys experienced along the way? Like, you know, on the whole, like, you're like, hey, I'm getting recognized. I'm brought to London for this opportunity because my work is being recognized. At the same time, it's like, actually, we don't want your work unless it looks like this. And so that's, those things can come together, which is the weird part of all this. So just kind of how, like, what has your guys' experience been as you've been, you know, telling and highlighting and focusing on the stories of your people? How is it received either broadly or like in a micro community? And then how is it, you know, what pushback or resistance are you guys kind of facing or have faced?
Yeah, you want to
start? Okay, I can start.
All right.
Yeah, I was just thinking back when I initially received this question. I was like, wow, a flood of different stories came to mind. I've been very fortunate in my photography career that I've had really wonderful experiences, especially with a lot of white male photographers who really showed me a lot. But also coupled with that, I've had a lot of negative experiences as well. And for me, I would say that when your stories begin to focus, like, well, just being an African-American woman, being, you know, a Black woman, I already knew, you know, all the different things that I would face. But what really became very challenging at a certain stage in my career is how much energy and effort, you know, I was constantly and consistently putting out, and then continuously still receiving this very odd form of rejection that had absolutely nothing to do with my work. Nothing to do with the technique of my photography technique, nothing to do, you know, with any of the technical aspects that go into creating a powerful image. And as that continuously happened, that was very exhausting for me personally. Not discouraging, really, because I already knew, you know, just from growing up as a Black person, like I shared on the previous talk that we had, and my parents being very active, you know, in preparing my sisters and I for what we were going to face in the world. But it just became so draining. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is, why am I receiving the same type of, I know why I'm receiving this, but why is this, you know, this is really hard. This keeps happening to me. And of course, in speaking with other creatives of color, we are all sharing similar stories and trying to combat this at the same time while just trying to get your work out there, right? So there's so many, I just wanted to share those different layers so there's a deeper understanding of all the energy that you're putting out there. And when my stories turned to focusing on people of color, while I had a lot of positive reactions, a lot of positive feedback, of course, there was always a lot of negative as well. And most of the negative feedback really just comes from a place of racism. I'm not going to sugarcoat it at all, because that's just simply what it is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of ignorance as well. So even with trying to get, I'll use the example of Black Boy Joy. You know, I say how positively it has been received. Well, when I go to apply for grants, and I apply for multiple grants, and anybody who's applied for a grant knows how long that process is, and especially photographers, there's a lot of detail and information that you need to put in. And of course, you're paying for this, right? This is not a free service. A lot of the grants, you have to pay for it. And then you're also putting all your time and energy into presenting your story. And then, you know, you consistently present Black Boy Joy or something along those lines, and you're receiving the constant rejection. And then you see later who's being picked, right, in the end, and you're like, well, how come there isn't any diversity in the selection? I don't understand. You know, why isn't there diversity there? And that can affect you in a really negative way, you know? Yeah. So for me, I'm a positive thinking person. I definitely always try to err on the side of optimism. I don't let those things deter me. I let them build me up and make me stronger. But of course, I'm human. So there's moments where there's a lot of frustration. Mm-hmm. And I've even seen my friends who are my Black, you know, people who are in the Black community, and people of color as well, who've expressed their frustration online. You know, they're very frustrated, so they're expressing it on Twitter or whatever media outlet they're deciding to use, social media outlet, and they're very upset. I mean, I just saw a friend of mine who's a very talented photographer, you know, expressing real frustration in feeling like, I know that I'm very good and I know that I'm very talented and I'm not even receiving any feedback, any constructive feedback for how I can improve my work so then I can receive this grant. So of course you're thinking, well, clearly they don't want this type of a story to be out there.
Yeah.
So, and then that ties right back into why people of color, why Black people, specifically why Black people created other outlets, you know, whether it be BET, you know, whether it be other grants that are just focused on African or African American work, whether it be media companies that are specifically looking to hire African American people or people of color. Like, these things were created because we were not allowed or allotted, you know, to be a part of these other organizations that are that are predominantly white. So we had to create something else. But you have to understand that there are so many of us, so many wonderful, beautiful people of color who are creating, but now we're only being given one or two opportunities, and they're like this odd competition that is not necessary starts to creep in, right, to all of this as well. And it can just be super challenging. So I think there's pushback that are coming from a lot of different directions. And I love that I'm seeing so many people talk about mental health this time around with everything that's going on, and really encouraging Black people to go out there and to get the help that they need during this time, because it's a lot. There's a lot that we're taking on. There's a lot that we're combating on a consistent basis. And if you are not in the right headspace, you'll allow those things to be extremely discouraging. So my pushback has definitely, like I said, come from just being a woman, being a Black woman, being a woman of color, and then how, you know, that has kind of filtered out into different interactions that I had. I mean, I could sit here with everybody who's listening and tell too many stories to count. That would be very surprising, I think, to many, about, you know, just not being able to move forward because I am just who I am.
Yeah.
No, that's again, just the same thing I said to Peter earlier, but thank you for sharing those things, because again, it's helpful for people to hear it and to understand it and to begin to wonder, and maybe it sparks a curiosity of like, what would I feel like if I was in that situation? Like, you know, I think there's this sentiment that's shared around, you know, like amongst people of color of like, we've got to be twice as good without any blemishes to be half as accepted. And it's like, you know, I was sharing last summer, I remember a friend of mine from church, him and his wife, white couple, they live in East Harlem, great family, great people. And we came to church, I wasn't preaching, but we came to church and he showed up to church and we were literally almost wearing like identical outfit, like, you know, similar style shirt, same color, similar style, like pants or whatever, similar style shoes. Same color shoes. The only difference was he was wearing shorts and I was wearing like khaki joggers. He was wearing khaki shorts. And, but it was like the same outfit. And I was like, oh, that's funny. I was like, I almost thought about wearing shorts today. And I think Krista was preaching. I almost thought about wearing shorts today, but I didn't want to wear them because I didn't I just feel weird. Like if I wear shorts, like someone's going to like use that as a reason to discredit me as the pastor. And you know, I'm like, it's my own church. It's like the church that I started. And yet I'm sitting here thinking like I'm already a minority. My church meets on 99th Street, which is officially East Harlem. We serve East Harlem and the Upper East Side neighborhood. But I'm like, someone might walk in and if I'm wearing shorts is going to think, oh, look, he's not serious or he doesn't God doesn't matter to him or whatever. And I'm not thinking about like, is a Black person going to accept me? I'm thinking about like, is a white person going to accept me? And I think, you know, you kind of referenced this whole idea of like the reality that Black communities have started other outlets, whether it's in grants or elsewhere. And I think about the conversation I had a few weeks back with Robbie Valderrama, who was talking about like in the church, you know, the oldest African-American Black denomination in the church is the AME church. And the first one started was because a Black man was in a white church on his knees praying and they would kick them out or were trying to get him out. And he refused to leave because he felt like he should be able to pray just like anyone else would. And they beat him and threw him out of the church. So for the sake of his health, he had to start a different organization, you know, and the Christian faith. And again, I think, you know, these kind of things like this, you know, which then also like creates this whole thing of like, was it racism? Like, well, how do you pinpoint that exactly other than, you know, your own experience and it just continues to play out the same way every single time. And you think, well, like what else is there? You know, I've improved tech, you know, the tech on the technicality. Oh, you mentioned like this, I'll share this briefly and I don't want to hog the conversation, but like when you're talking about like people looking for other stuff, right. Looking for other examples. I was just having this conversation, within the last week or two. But I remember I got pulled over in my neighborhood. I lived in Washington State, and I got pulled over by a police officer for looking suspicious. And I got pulled over four houses down from the house that I owned, that I bought, like that I was paying a mortgage on. And he pulls me over and says, oh, you know why I pulled you over? I said, no. And he said, a neighbor said that you look, they see you driving in and out of here all the time and you look suspicious. And I said, officer, I drive in and out of here all the time because I live right there. And I pointed at my house. So he's like, well, let me see your license, registration, blah, blah, all that garbage. No reason to pull me over. I wasn't speeding, didn't break any laws, you know, did nothing other than tried driving to my house. He comes back. He's like, all right, I'm gonna let you go. And I had my dog. My dog was sitting in the passenger seat, the front seat of the car. And he's like, oh, is your dog registered with the city? I said, no. What do you mean? And he's like, all dogs have to be registered with the city. I could give you a citation for that. So, but I'm gonna let you go on this time. So make sure you register your dog with the city. And in my head, I thought, I was like, has this guy ever given a citation to someone for not registering their dog with the city? Like, but it was like this feeling of like nitpicking, like, oh, I couldn't get you on something. And so now let me see if I can find one more thing that I can attack. And I think that's the plight of people of color and Black people in America, is like, there's always one other thing. Like, and again, you see that whether it's some, you know, George Floyd or whoever else came before, whoever else comes after. What was he resisting? What was he doing? What it like? And it's like, and it's always one more thing. And it's like, it's just burdensome. It's tiresome. It's fatiguing. It's exasperating. And it's like, and yeah, and it just goes back to that feeling of like, man, we got to be twice as good with no blemishes to be half as accepted. And it's like, that's the hardest part, you know, like the emotional wear and tear.
People are like, thank you for sharing that too, Ricky, because I'm so grateful that in the time and space that we're in now, that we're able to share this openly. Of course, it's going to be received differently from a lot of different people, but the fact that so many, especially young people, I mean, they are just like killing it. I love just to see all the wonderful things that they're doing. But I love that now we are able to actually talk about that exhaustion level, talk about how it feels, because for so long, of course, it's especially to protect ourselves, we just have to talk about, you know, the strength and being powerful and overcoming, which are all very important things. But we also have to acknowledge these other components as well and take care of ourselves. And how are we taking care of ourselves? And just like you said, with the nitpicking, I want to be really clear that people can understand that it's really important that if something isn't what you want, right? Like if you're applying for something and technically it's not what you're looking for, you think the person can improve, you can share that information with them. Because oftentimes what happens, especially for people of color, is that we're not even given that. You know, we're not even asked to improve on something. It's actually just completely asked for everything to be scrapped and changed. So if you sit, I would love for people to really just sit with that and to take that in. Yeah. Something that you've worked extremely hard on, something that you feel is technically sound, right? Or whatever it may be. Then you're presenting that, and then now you're being told that all of that needs to be completely scrapped and needs to fit into this narrative. And we're not saying you don't wiggle, you know, you don't make things work to fit into what it needs to. But this all ties back into unconscious bias, to systemic racism. And we, in order for us to reach a place of reconciliation, which you know, I'm definitely looking towards and looking forward to, we have to be able to express these things openly, because then we won't be able to get anywhere. And I've seen some organizations, you know, that they are putting out different things, and I really hope that they are taking the time internally to examine those components, and not just about, hey, let's just bring on, you know, all these Black people just for the sake of it, that you're choosing Black people that, you know, are technically sound, you know, are do have this beautiful artwork, that it is important that they're skilled, that they're trained. You know, we're not asking to, you know, for anybody, exactly, just anyone to come along. You know, we're saying, look, we're creative. You know, we have all of these wonderful different components, and we're multifaceted, and we deserve just as much of a shot as anybody else. And also, too, it gets to a point with those other organizations being open, like I mentioned before, where many people, you know, they don't want to have to keep on trying to continuously receive, you know, the same response. You know, after a while, you are just going to be like, you know, I'm just going to create something on my own. This is what I'm going to put out there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's good. That's good. Yeah. As you know, we kind of move to like wrapping up. Like, are any like final thoughts or anything you wanted to add to that, Peter? Just kind of whether it's about that particular part of the conversation or anything that we have covered already.
My thing is, I think in all due fairness, there are some organizations that are really open to diversity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for me to be in the UK for the first place, you know, that has to be there. They could have probably not like picked me because I was not there when they selected people, right? So, but there are also a lot of those other organizations or media outlets or whatever thing that they just don't have that diversity. They just don't want to see anything that has to do with people of color, except if their own color is the one that go there to do that particular story, then they are okay with that, they are cool with that. So I have received a lot of, you know, pushbacks, and I have also received, you know, both positive and negative, you know, pushbacks, really. And, you know, even like the granting that she talked about, that's, I just don't want to dwell more on that, but that happens a lot, whereby there are some of them that you really need to, like, applied for, that is even made for them, for that particular region or particular color, right? And still yet, there's still a level of whereby there's no equal opportunities for all the filmmakers or all the photographers that are really applying for that particular grant, right? So there's a way they screen all of us out anyway. And there are some that will just say, once you're like, just say where you're from, you know, say particular race where you're from, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, submit your passport photograph or whatever, you know, do a video of talking about this whole thing. There are ways for them to, like, you know, really screen everybody out. But deep down, they really know the kind of people they really want anyway. So when you keep receiving a lot of those pushbacks, it kind of, like, really weigh you down, right? Then you have to not try to pick up yourself again, pick yourself up by focusing more on the positive side that also have to come with, you know, other organizations as well, you know. So, but there are some that, you know, they'll send the particular one. I don't like those, you know, emails sometimes when they like send it about, hey, how talented you are and all of that. But if I was not talented, I'm not sure I was going to apply to that in at first place anyway. So I don't need them to really like remind me of that. You know, I just, if they can really explain the reason why, which they will never explain, they will never let you know the reason why you were not picked anyway, or why you didn't get a grant. They will never say that, you know. So these things are all like built in. You know, this takes us back to what I said earlier about this economic superiority. In all of these things we'll be saying, it's been playing out on my mind about even the poverty you guys talked about, that Tee really expatiated more on, about how they go in there to, you know, dump whatever. So there's this system going around in all the aspects about how they just want everything to revolve around what they are doing in any way. They will try and factor you in, but only when they want you to come in. So you cannot have, you know, 3 or 5 black people or Africans in one particular segment or whatever fund that they are bidding for at the same time. You have to, like, have one person. So after a period of years, like after 10 years after, so let's bring another black person in again. So, you know, just follow. So you cannot see like 5, 6 black people at the same time, you know, really doing this thing. So this is what is going on, you know. So it's very discouraging. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to like just, how will I put this now? Just try and look into yourself and build your own confidence and try to like really fight the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I just wanted to like also contribute to that part, because you guys have really dealt with it very well. So
to talk much about. Me and Ricky handled it.
Yeah.
No, that's super helpful. And I think, you know, hopefully this conversation, I feel like you know, helps people find like practical steps in between, like on a personal level in terms of like connecting with not just, you know, it's one thing to watch a documentary. It's another thing to like live life or spend time with a Black person or a person of color. You know what I mean? We can inform ourselves through documentaries and through, you know, what we read or find out about. But our heart changes when it's connected to someone else and it's tethered to another person. And I think that's, you know, in this, like this conversation, I think what we're trying to help people see is like, these are hearts, you know, these are like, it's more than just like, here's a film or here's a photograph or, you know, here's an article that you saw someone share on Twitter or Facebook. Like these are people and their stories matter. And as they begin to matter to us, we start to see, you know, it kind of like broadens our perspective and our capacity to care at the same time. And so it's so important. So I'm going to, just like I did last time, I'm going to connect in the show notes to all of like your guys' social stuff so people can find out, connect with you guys and see if you want to buy, whether it's like T's Let Love Lead shirt that she's wearing or the Black Boy Joy shirt that I'm wearing or like these prints or the 100% me, any of these things on a whole array of apparel or designs, you can, we'll link to all of that. But guys, thank you so much. I'm T Makoje and grateful for you guys. So thanks everyone for listening and watching and we'll be back with another conversation at some point soon.